As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Hello, welcome back to the Athletic Football Tactics podcast. Great to have you with us this week. I'm Ali Maxwell. And with me today, he means you no harm, is Liam Tharm.
Hello.
But always be wary. Here's Mark Carey.
I love it. Hello.
Good, because I'm excited about the topic. And one of the great treats, I think, of hosting this pod is being able to mix up topical stuff, such as a quick look at Postecoglou's start at Spurs, which I really enjoyed last week, or the Premier League notebook that we did the week before. And then some topics where we zoom out a little bit and have a discussion about wider trends, things that we may or may not have noticed, those sorts of topics. That's where we are today. And I'm going to call this one from the centre of midfield to the dugout. And I'm looking at Liam Tharm because really, Liam, you're in the centre of the park today. You're in the dugout, if you like, because this is all about your big piece from today.
Yeah, this has kind of started off as a bit of a thought experiment. I was speaking to Duncan, of course, has been on this very pod, who's currently my editor. And we were just discussing that it felt like a lot of the modern managers or head coaches, I should say, I guess that's slightly interchangeable, had careers, particularly these now top managers and the younger ones coming through, as central midfielders. And we're sort of saying that it feels like that's part of the big shift towards almost everyone wanting to play possession football, wanting to play these similar sorts of shapes where they're now doing similar things with their fullbacks, similar things with their wingers. And it's basically contributed to a lot more similarities now between the top teams. You sort of said this at the end of last season where sort of Liverpool, Arsenal, Manchester City were all sort of playing a similar sort of way. And just thought it was funny that it's going to be 2 decades next year, I think it's next June, for Mourinho's sort of first press conference at Chelsea, where he said that he thinks he's a special one. And that quote sort of, people take that as being sort of very self-idolizing, but when you actually translate that from Portuguese, it can sort of mean a bit peculiar, a bit unique, which I think a lot of people will always see his teams having been very different. And there was a quote from Xavi in 2019 where he said, I like a different kind of football. This is speaking about Mourinho. I'm not criticizing, but I don't enjoy playing football in that way. And my teams will never have that attitude, which is quite damning. And I just thought is even more now than ever before, someone like Mourinho is definitely seen as a tactical outsider.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because off the top of my head, when you bring that up, you think of Pep Guardiola, you think of Mikel Arteta, you think of Xavi, of course. But outside of that, I'm hoping you actually crunch the numbers to work out whether your initial thought experiment was actually true. Is there a disproportionate amount of former central midfielders in the dugout?
You say I crunched the numbers. I went to some experts who crunched numbers even better than I possibly could. I went to a report from the CIS Football Observatory, which is a really, really good Swiss-based research group, and they specialise in football statistical analysis, which is obviously right up our street. And there was a report they did in March 2022. They looked at over 1,800 teams from 120 different leagues in like 90 different countries all across the world. And they found that, of course, midfielders were the most dominant positional group. So there are more midfielders and more defenders than you get forwards and goalkeepers. But both defenders and midfielders were overrepresented among managers that had a professional career. So both are about 4% more in terms of their representation among the managerial group. And you had many fewer goalkeepers and many fewer forwards being coaches. And my instinctive reaction to that was, it makes sense for goalkeepers because they would probably go and become goalkeeper coaches. That's quite an easy sort of pathway through it. So specialised. And I think we now naturally associate many forwards with becoming pundits and then talking about sort of the art of goal scoring and those sorts of details. And Pep Guardiola said something similar actually about Arteta in 2019 when he was asked, you know, does he think he'll become a good head coach? Of course, before he went on to be really, really good with Arsenal and continues to be good with Arsenal, and sort of said that, you know, goalkeepers and strikers are so focused on the end actions that midfielders sort of do a bit more of everything in the middle of midfield and they've got a sort of broader picture. And he just called it a really, really valuable lesson or an important lesson for sort of learning in terms of sort of a football education, which I think largely makes sense to me.
Yeah, you mentioned pundits there. I haven't quite crunched the numbers in the same way, but I did kind of list it. And I do think that you could probably extrapolate the midfield and defence side of things more to punditry. So I, certainly in the UK, I think. So I looked at it in terms of, so Sky Sports, the main ones being Carragher and Neville, but then Jamie Redknapp, Souness, obviously last season, Micah Richards, Roy Keane. I think Karen Carney is probably the most attack-minded of that group, I'd say. I know that Daniel Sturridge has been brought on board this season. Then BBC, you've got Danny Murphy, Jermaine Genus, Ashley Williams, Alex Scott, Martin Keogh and Farrah Williams, all midfielders and defenders. Of course, Alan Shearer and Ian Wright are the obvious exceptions to that. And then you think Rachel Brown-Finnis as a former goalkeeper. She's probably the only former goalkeeper as a pundit that I can really think of. I know that formerly BT Sport, TNT Sport, I've got Rhea Ferdinand, Owen Hargreaves, Jolene Lescott. They're probably the most forward-minded when you think of people like Joe Cole, Peter Crouch, Michael Owen, Lucy Ward. I think the point still remains that whether it's punditry or, of course, coaching, which is obviously the crux of today's episode, that the point still remains that it is more midfield and defence and less so forward or attacking players.
I spoke to some analysts and some coaches as well that work, I'll say, slightly in elite level, some work in academies, and obviously that's a contentious word there, but work in the professional game and do this for a living. And they sort of echoed a lot of those things and sort of said that central midfield is often the area where the best technical players are put, or sort of the smartest footballing brains. They're seen very much, you know, it's the engine room is the sort of the cliche term. And Pep Linders on the Training Ground Guru podcast had a very similar point that he made about when he coached at academy level. He'd always put those smartest players and the most technically excellent players in central midfield, because he said it's the position he felt that gets pressed the most. So you basically have to be the most responsive to time pressure. And I guess it sort of ties into management and coaching in a degree of like operating and acting under pressure. So it's sort of the broader skill set. It's not just, oh, they're in the middle of the pitch, they've got the best view, they're going to liaise between players, they're often captains. It's also, I guess, that ability to deal with the psychological side of it. And it's not just like they're massive tactical nerds and that translates into it that way.
I think another underrated one is more of a softer skill is communication skills, I think. So you have to, as a central midfielder, you've kind of got the viewpoint, or as a central defender, you've got the viewpoint that maybe others don't if they're making runs or they've got their back to play. And you think being able to coach your team through it on the pitch, often you think about it, central defenders and central midfielders being the captain as well, and conveying that message in a really clear and concise manner on the pitch isn't too dissimilar from doing it on the side of the pitch and being able to do that. So often the central midfielders are, yes, they need to get their formal coaching badges, but they've had that experience leading up to it to be able to deliver messages tactically in real time on the pitch. And I think that obviously is something that's transferable as well.
I find this really interesting because, I mean, we're always threatening to generalize a little bit when we're bunching up a position on the pitch and therefore the people that play in that position and therefore what they must be like as players and then later on in their careers as managers. But it is tempting to do it. And there are some strands that you can pull at that sort of feel good and feel right, if you like. I mean, I always used to think, probably until this conversation, maybe, you know, growing up in the 90s and the 2000s, that it was centre-backs that were managers. And, you know, if we carry on the discussion like how you've been talking about midfielders, I suppose the logic, as far as I understood it, for why a centre-back would lend itself to being a strong manager, more so than other positions on the pitch, would be actually probably more about leadership and being the organisers of a back line, being the ones barking the orders, which was always kind of what centre-backs were meant to be doing, certainly when I was growing up. And maybe there's something in football before the last 15 years or 10, 15 years, perhaps, and football management being more about aspects of leadership, managing personalities, being a strong leader type in the dressing room and overseeing a whole group and motivating that group. Whereas now, the types that we have at the very top of the game, of course, they still have those qualities. They have to. But the level of tactical detail is, to my eyes, much higher than it was previously. And maybe that's why we might be moving towards the central midfielders being a larger part of the managerial pool.
Yeah, I'd encourage people to go back and listen to our two-parter on sort of the state of football management from sort of the tail end of last season, because I think we sort of really went through the evolution and the changes there. So I won't go into too much depth about some of that. But I think the interesting thing that you look at now, and I think is why also centre-backs, particularly ones that are played in sort of possession systems, but football has become such a passing game in recent years. The game's become quicker and faster in terms of the number of passes. Players have got considerably fitter, and it's more of a high-intensity sport than it previously was. There's a great visualisation from the 21st group, and they show that successful passes have been continuously on the rise, increasing by 25% from 2008-2009 to 2022-23. We have interestingly sort of hit a little bit of a plateau. I guess it's now a balance of, and we're seeing this with some top teams now, of, okay, there's almost a saturation point you reach where you can get too much possession or too many short passes, and then the space starts opening up in behind, or you want to play transitional because other teams are doing it. But I wanted to reference some quotes from Mauricio Pochettino on an interview he did with Alan Shearer that's up on the site if people want to read it. And he sort of speaks about the evolution for when he first came in at Southampton and then at Tottenham. And this I quote, he said, "When we arrived here, you'd have 20 teams in the Premier League, and it was difficult to find two or three teams playing in the same kind of style. It was all different and really attractive and exciting. Before Klopp or Pep Guardiola arrived, our concept and principle was to press high and build from the back. And the only other team that tried to play from the back that way was Liverpool under Brendan Rodgers. Now it's like all the teams try to build from the back. All the teams try to press high all the time. It's like it was contagious." And if you go back now and you look at, there's good data on FPRF, that sort of goalkeeper launch rate, which are passes kicked sort of 40 plus yards. They've just trended down every season from 2017, 2018. They're down about, I think it's just over 20% in terms of goal kicks. And of course, the law change a few years ago enticed that as well to play short. But even in open play, they're playing about 18% now compared to sort of 6 years ago, passes short. And I think we often look back to sort of five seasons ago, which was City's Centurion season, and think not a huge amount has changed. Sort of tactically, there's some innovations, but it doesn't feel that different. But in terms of sort of building out, and now when you look across the teams, almost everyone is playing short, even to some degree, even bottom half teams. It's the way now.
So it's not surprising that in many walks of life and in sport and in football, people generally are attracted to those that are winning. And so something like this is likely to come from people looking at those dominating the sport and trying to copy them, imitate them, get closer to them in terms of style. But do you also think there's something in the types of managers that we have, many of them forward central midfielders, having a big impact on the style, because that's just how they played the game, that's how they learned the game? You know, to put it simply, midfielders like passing, so now there's more passing. Is that kind of what you're suggesting?
Also, to a degree, definitely. There's good quotes from Pep where he says, "Oh, I'd play with 1,000 midfielders if I could." And of course, you look at, I think people like he and Arteta can be sort of very specific case studies because they've played in such specific and sort of high quality teams that isn't always sort of comparable elsewhere. But and we spoke about it before, I think, with Arteta in regards to sort of squad building with Postecoglou and Spurs, and that, you know, when he first came in at Arsenal, he started with a 4-2-3-1 and switched to a 3-4-3, and they won an FA Cup that way and they finished the season quite well. And he said a quote at the end of the season where he said that we want to move to a 4-3-3, but we're players short. And that sort of fascinated me, is from a coaching managerial perspective, that almost the end goal for you is this formation, this style of play, whereas, and this is a very English perspective, that the football that I think people from sort of my generation and definitely the generation above were raised on was that, you know, you play to win to a degree, and that your style is sort of secondary. But in continental Europe, from what I'm told and what I've learned, that it's a very different thing, that style is as important, if not more, particularly in the Netherlands, particularly in Spain, that these places hold a real, there's a cultural value. I think there's more cultural significance to how they play, that's part of their identity and what they do. And I think that is now why we see so many of these managers that are coming through have made defensive midfielders and central midfielders so expensive now and lucrative. And I think it surprises everyone because they don't score goals or save goals, and people normally associate the money being sort of in both boxes because that's where you're going to win games. But it's the control aspect. And I guess if you were a central midfielder, you could going to probably build your team around that because that's what you know, that's your wheelhouse, if you like, that's your area of expertise.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to come back to the defensive midfield and the central midfield differences of how the supply and demand of a defensive midfielders kind of inflates their price tag. But just going back to the style of play thing as well, I think as much as anything, it's not just passing for passing's sake in terms of having this style of play, but I think it is positively reinforcing in the way that it has actually improved, especially at the elite level, but even at the league level. And just going back to what you said about goal kicks and playing short goal kicks, I did a piece last season that distinguished between short goal kicks and long goal kicks and the likelihood of you scoring within the next 60 seconds from the goal kick. And shorter goal kicks, I was going to say contrary to popular belief, but it makes complete sense that shorter goal kicks had a higher likelihood of scoring within 60 seconds compared with longer goal kicks. So even from evidence and data, you know, you can see that this is a better way of playing. Mm. It's actually going to help your teams score a goal compared with conceding versus just, oh, I want more possession for possession's sake. It actually leads to greater territory, you know, within that sequence of play. So of course, I'm going to add the numbers in, but I do think it actually has positively reinforcing value.
Well, I was going to bring up the word data as well. I think this has a massive say in what we're talking about, this homogeneity in the type of football that we're seeing played at the top level. I think that's a massive factor. The extent to which, fairly slowly at first, and then to me anyway, very quickly, numbers and data became highly important in measuring how teams play, and then extending on from that, trying to work out what makes good teams good and how to be better as a team, and using numbers rather than old school methods of eye tests and experience and coaching and opinions to do so. Let's say hypothetically you were to be asked to write a report for someone on the trends of the top clubs, whether it was in the Premier League or even, let's say, in the Championship or in League One. If you were to do a statistical trends piece on the teams that are successful, a lot of what you'd get back would be, you know, high possession, high press. The majority of the teams that have done well over the last X amount of years, whichever time period you're asked, will have ticked those boxes. And therefore, I think there would be a sort of basic conclusion. These are the sorts of things that we should look to do then. We should look to build through the thirds because that's what good teams do. We should look to press high because that's what good teams do. And for me, that's probably as big a factor as anything else, because it feels like most professional teams now have probably done some sort of work on that. And that's a lot of the conclusions that have been spat out. Whether that's a good thing or not, whether that's true in all cases, whether that's the right thing for certain clubs to be aspiring to, I think that's a completely different question.
There's also the big impact that has on academy level in particular, where now there's sort of some very justifiable and fair critiques that you end up trying to develop these players that you can only sort of play in one set way. And regardless of what that way is, that's always not great because the game is going to evolve. And when you're, you know, if you're working with an under 10 player, then you're trying to develop them for what the game will be like in 10 years time, not what it is sort of right now. And that was a big sort of golden thread from the people that I spoke to sort of running through that work within the game. And one of them made a very fair point about saying that it's great when top coaches do it, but that's also because, and we've spoken about this before, a lot of them have top players who are the best players that can do these things, that at times, if you're then trying to play this way and you've got players that I won't necessarily say are inferior, but suit playing a different style. I think West Ham are a perfect case study for this. They've got some of the best ball carriers in the entire league, particularly that can attack on their own individually. Jarrod Bowen stands out in particular for being so two-footed, and Mark and I have written on that before. Mikel Antonio is one of the best 1v2 strikers in the entire league. And their execution of game plans recently against both Chelsea and against Brighton, and in their entire Conference League run last year, where they, you know, Moyes didn't sort of die on a sword and say, oh, we're going to keep playing this possession football that we tried to play. They've sold Gianluca Scamacca. They tried these things and have gone, okay, it doesn't work for us, and we'll go and we'll have success sort of our way. And I think that just goes to show that for me is really good management. People might say, oh, it's bad coaching because they want to see a different side of play, but that is maximizing the players and the resources that he has. And on a human level, I think that's, he couldn't do much more.
A lot of it comes back to this. What became a sort of accepted truth was that higher possession was more aesthetically pleasing to watch. I think there's probably been quite a lot of pushback on that over the last few years, but it did become almost like an accepted thing to say and accepted thing to think. I mean, some of the worst football I've watched in the last few years has been when a team is trying to play a possession-based style, but they haven't either been coached well enough to have decent patterns in order to actually break down defenses, or they don't have the players that suit that style of play. I mean, it can be entertaining to watch because it can be shambolic. Like, some of the goals that get given away are absolutely unbelievable compared to many years ago. But that's not good football to watch for me. Like, I've started to appreciate much more the teams that attack quickly on the counter-attack and are able to create those sort of situations. You know, we're only a few weeks into the season, but Blackburn Rovers in the Championship, they're not an unbelievable team. They're not winning loads and loads of matches, but watching them attack is fantastic because they don't press unbelievably high. They sit in a bit of a shape. When they win it, wow, their attack is fantastic. And it all happens in the blink of an eye, and I'm loving watching it. But I just find the whole discussion very interesting.
You're listening to the Athletic Football Tactics Podcast with Ali Maxwell.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
The Premier League is back, and the Athletic Football Podcast is your essential football companion this season. Whether it's dissecting Chelsea's astronomical spending, assessing Spurs in a post-Harry Kane era, or the growing impact of Saudi Arabia's riches, we'll be there 4 days a week this season as we get to the heart of the biggest stories. Join me, Ayo Akinwolere, and the Athletic's esteemed roster of writers on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and the usual podcast spaces.
My personal take is that now, we talked about it the other day with Liverpool and Chelsea, top team versus top team in the Premier League, those matches, the blockbuster games, if you like, are, to me anyway, about as entertaining as they've ever been, because the clash of these styles and what these teams are trying to do does create some remarkable games and some amazing scorelines. And maybe that's down to homogeneity of style. I think non-blockbuster team versus non-blockbuster team in the Premier League is also better than it's ever been, I think, aesthetically and in terms of the games that are being produced, the quality of the football, the possibility of different results and teams going for the win, essentially. But Big Six versus non-Big Six, I personally find difficult to watch and not so engaging, just because I find the rhythm so samey now.
Yeah, I think that's definitely the case when the style of the minnow in this example is basically trying to do a sort of poor man's version of the giant, so to speak. But I do think there are exceptions to the rule, probably more as case studies, because I do agree with your point in terms of the trends. But there are, you know, the examples. I mean, you mentioned David Moyes before, Liam. I think that could be a really good one. And it's quite refreshing to see Andoni Iraola's Bournemouth that we mentioned in the preview. I'd be really interesting to see how much that kind of evolves as a bit of an antidote to certain possession football, because, yeah, they like to press high, which a lot of the top teams do, but they're very direct with their long balls. And they were a giant kick. Well, Iraola's style of play was a giant killing style in La Liga last season. So you think of maybe Marcelo Bielsa's Leeds as well. They were a bit of a different animal. Chris Wilder's Sheffield United in the way that they had overlapping centre-backs. There are some sort of case studies, more the exception to the rule, as I say. But broadly speaking, I do sort of see your point. I think the final example would probably be Brentford as well. Mm-hmm. And that they are just, I looked into it last season, they had as good a record against the big six as Manchester City. So 21 points they gained, which shows that they were just their style of play, as we know, with their wing backs and their direct style, of course, their use of set pieces was, as much as anything, which I think feeds into your point, Ali, it was refreshing. The fact that we talked about them so much, we're still talking about them now because it was different rather than it necessarily being trying to do what the top teams are doing, but just not quite the same quality of player.
I think Brentford are phenomenal because they get boxed in as this very sort of data-driven team. But I think their biggest quality, I'm not speaking any authority on this, is what I assume from watching them, is they seem so open-minded about how they play. Thomas Frank will at times play a certain style and a certain shape against big six teams, against sort of lower quality opposition. They'll try and play more expansively and try and be more attack-minded. But there seems to be no sort of set end goal. And there was a really, really good discussion between him and Graham Potter. I think it was pre-match between Brentford and Chelsea last season. And obviously, it's really rare you get to see two managers sort of interview each other. And Thomas Frank was sort of saying to Potter, oh, why do you keep changing your formation in games? And Potter was saying, well, it's not really the end goal for us. It's obviously not seeing it as these units necessarily, but it's about sort of player positioning sort of interactions. And I wonder if we've reached a point where I think the idea of like stubbornness tactically was always put on defensive teams of like, oh, they're always going to sit back. They're always going to play a 4-5-1 or a 5-4-1, however it's going to look. And if they go 1-0 down, they're not going to get back into the game. They need this game to pan out a certain way. I wonder if we're reaching that, or we've reached that already with some of the possession teams. I think Arteta has consistently sort of bemoaned the amount of low blocks that Arsenal continuously face, but the best way to defend against his possession style is to sit passively and to deny the space, to congest the areas where people like Martin Odegaard or Declan Rice want to operate in those central midfield positions, to double up in wide areas on the wingers because they're such key goal-scoring threats. There was a quote from Roberto De Zerbi after Brighton won at Wolves where he said that he can't change his style, that it's his DNA. And again, he's a player, I'm told, is a really sort of attack-minded number 10. And you can see that borne out in the way that he wants his teams to play football at Sassuolo, at Shakhtar, and now at Brighton. And I wonder if that's, again, even more praise to Pep Guardiola for just being so adaptable. And we've spoken before about like the different literal iterations that City have had, that, you know, he's done different things with his number nine, with his false nine, his strikers, with his wingers playing same side, playing inverted wingers. He's played wide overlapping fullbacks. He's played fullbacks inside. There's been back threes, back fours. There's been every sort of different style now. And obviously people are now finding it almost a bit humorous that he's going to this defensive 4-4-2 with four big guys at the back to head and kick crosses and balls into the box away. So I think just that open-mindedness, because at the end of the day, you're working with sort of human beings, that we can reduce it tactically to sort of numbers and systems and shapes. But he just seems to, and I know he has tons of money in a transfer market that also really, really helps, but gets quite a lot out of the players that he's got at hand.
I mean, you bring it to the present day as well, in terms of Brighton losing to West Ham. Football's always about cycles, isn't it? And I'm not suggesting that was the catalyst or will be the catalyst for a new cycle, but Brighton want the opposition to come onto them so they can bait the press and work through it. We've spoken about that at length. And David Moyes' West Ham were like, we're not going to do that. So you can try and break us down and then we'll hit you on the counter. And again, talking about it being in cycles, that it is the perfect antidote maybe to this possession style football. And maybe we'll start to see more of that growing. And then, you know, who knows what will happen in the future. But Inter Milan only last season being an example of that in the Champions League. We spoke about how styles make fights. And one of the main reasons it was so interesting to watch Manchester City play Inter Milan, and the fact we gave Inter Milan a fighting chance, was because their styles were so contrasting. And it was, okay, Man City, we're absolutely fine with you having the ball. We're going to use our strength, which is counter-attacking football. So as soon as something maybe becomes more and more homogenous, you start to try and think of ways to then get an edge on that. And then once that becomes homogenous, you know, it cascades from there. So I'm sure that this style right now will not necessarily be the style in 10, 20 years' time, for the simple reason of footballing evolution.
Because I think one of the key words from the last 5 to 10 years or so, a lot of the top managers that we're talking about, has been an obsession with control. So in some aspects, that means controlling possession of the ball, because if we have it, then they don't have it, that sort of thing. And, you know, we want to be the ones in control of the ball. But there's probably other ways in which an obsession with control is sort of reflected in a manager's tactics and strategy. But I guess what we're learning more and more off the back of that is that the secondary skill, because being able to put together a game plan that does achieve control is clearly what a lot of managers aspire to. But I think we're now seeing that a secondary skill, and a very important one, becomes, and how will my team respond if we don't achieve control and we're 20 minutes into the game and things aren't going our way? That's where stubbornness, like as quite a childish trait, right? Stubbornness, yeah. Not being able to handle things that's not, when they're not going your way. That's when I think some teams seem to struggle when things aren't going their way. You know, Mikel Arteta complaining that teams are coming up against him in a low block, like that's quite a childish thing. It's not up to you. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? And can you show the adaptability to say, okay, understood, and here's what we're going to do next in order to handle this and get results without just complaining about it?
There's a really interesting sort of broader point in this as well that one of the coaches raised to me that I didn't think about at first, and it's that a lot of FAs now are teaching on their coaching courses, on their coaching badges, to coaches to play in this style, the England DNA that was brought in sort of the early 2010s that, you know, has largely revolutionized the way that the senior men's team has played, and is something that was brought in to play across all teams, all age groups, all genders, all types, to be that sort of dominant possession style, to control games. They of course spoke about tactical flexibility and stuff in there, but the headline of it was basically, we want more of the ball, we want to do more attacking. There's a great sort of line graph from Opta Analyst that sort of charts England's style change in terms of their passes per sequence and their direct speed upfield, and that's in the piece if people want to see it, all the way from sort of being right up in the top left corner, being a fast and direct team in sort of the late 90s and Euro 2000, all the way to being just completely more slow and intricate now down there with sort of Spain in terms of a style of play. And it's interesting that is sort of what gets taught, and I guess that is then just a learned thing and copy, because we go, oh, the other teams that have been successful have done it this way, therefore we need to do it this way. Which is an ironic contrast to the fact that a lot of the long ball stuff is, of course, also rooted in sort of the research from the Charles Reap era. And I wonder if that's now why a lot of the emerging young English coaches also seem to have been central midfielders. So you've got Gary O'Neill, Steven Gerrard, Frank Lampard, Scott Parker, Michael Carrick and Middlesbrough. I know Rooney was a number 10, but again, a player that was known for being technically excellent and really, really good on the ball. I don't feel like we're seeing as many English sort of fullbacks, definitely not sort of strikers, coming through. And that's,
it's interesting because of that group, I would still say that only Michael Carrick's profile was framed as a sort of footballing intellectual sitting at the base of midfield, never sprinting because he didn't need to, because he was always one step ahead. You know what I mean? Which is kind of what I think of when I think of the Pep, the Xavi, you know, that sort of type. You know, Lampard, Gerrard, Rooney when he dropped deeper, Parker.
I put Parker in there as the very, very stylish, late shirt Parker. Tucked in. Yeah, yeah.
Right. Yeah, but yeah, he wasn't an elite ball player though, I don't think, Parker. I don't think he was a great... My memories of Parker were kind of box-to-boxy, roll your sleeves up, you know, get involved in all aspects of play and be a very good all-rounder, rather than this sort of, I can play at walking speed because I'm just one step ahead of everyone. It is interesting. And of course, this summer, one of the major transfer window trends seems to be defensive midfielders, central midfield players becoming the ones that the elite teams are after and the ones that the elite teams are willing to spend an awful lot of money on. So do we think this is also a consequence of what we're discussing here?
Yeah, absolutely. As we were saying before, that I think central midfielders that become managers are going to want elite level central midfielders to really, really form their team around. Declan Rice, obviously one of the obvious ones. Chelsea also bringing in, you know, multiple central defensive midfielders, having also brought in Enzo Fernandez, you know, almost a year or so ago now, or 7 or 8 months. And I know he's not, I think it's hard to sort of categorize him as what type of midfielder he is, because he doesn't really do a huge amount of defending, but he's just a really, really elite ball player. And we're now seeing him possibly playing further forward, which I think is exciting as well. You've got Jude Bellingham moving. We've had in recent windows already, and Tchouaméni, Eduardo Camavinga, who's Ancelotti is admittedly playing at fullback, but as openly said, at some point he'll play in central midfield. He's just got to learn a bit there for now, which I just think is quite funny. And clearly there's more of a plan in there. But even Brighton now going for Carlos Baleba from Lille, who's played, you know, a few hundred minutes and has gone for £30 million or so, I think is the reported fee. So it's clear that I think now is. These profiles become so incredibly expensive once they start to mature. People just having to start buying these. And this is the same, I think, now for all positions, earlier and younger, and buying players sort of moves in advance where you'd go. Previously, we'd let them go elsewhere, say it's a player coming from South America or somewhere in Asia, Australasia, Africa. Clubs are now buying direct. Of course, those that have the luxury and the money and the resources that have either feeder clubs or multi-club groups, which are a much bigger sort of talking point in the transfer sense, can use those to buy a player, send them somewhere. And those clubs that don't have those resources, I think, really suffer. And that's probably not quite fair. But a lot of clubs are just having to take gambles now. We saw the same thing, I think, with Manchester United and Rasmus Højlund, that's not a move they'd have made normally for that much money, but you're paying for potential now, almost more than you're paying the sort of performance of what might I get of 2, 3, 4, 5 seasons plus a sell-on from this player in the future.
I think with this summer transfer window as well, the fact that there's the defensive midfielders are going for such astronomical fees are largely dictated by, yes, the fact that managers want to play this way and the importance of that position has grown and grown. I think the Enzo Fernandez figure that was in January just completely broke the market a little bit, and that's happened in the past, but it was used as a benchmark, wasn't it, to say, well, if Enzo Fernandez is this much, then Declan Rice has got to be there or thereabouts, and you can extrapolate that to Caicedo and Lavia, etc. But I think, yeah, as much as anything as well, it's a supply and demand issue. I think because it is quite a specialist position, it's just if there's not a large crop of players who are able to fulfill all of the aspects of that role, then there's going to be a premium on it. And the reason I say that in terms of all the attributes as well is that it might be a generalization. But so I did a piece on this with, or it was led by Stu James, and I helped him out with it. And it was a really interesting piece from Stu in terms of all of the people that he spoke to. But in years gone by, it's a generalization, but I think it was more double pivot as a 4-2-3-1 where you'd have the kind of the bulldozing, destructive terrier to go and win the ball back. And then you'd have the ball playing one who would then get on the ball and build attacks from there. Whereas the best exemplar is, of course, Rodri, who's tasked with doing both, covering a lot of space physically. And we've spoken about Manchester City being the ones to buy and invest in big physical players. But now they're tasked with being really, really strong on the ball, technically being able to build out from the back and build attacks, but being destructive at the same time and being able to do both to an elite level. And I think the kicker in all of this, which is really interesting from what Stu found, was he gave an example of Ibrahim Sangare at PSV and the fact that he wasn't considered elite because he's not press resistant enough. Mm. His ball playing ability is fine if he's got a bit of time. But you think about your Caicedos and your Fernandezes of this world, where they're able to distribute the ball with under real intense pressure. Mm. And that is such a big part when you're building out from the back in modern elite football. So putting all of those together in the melting pot to have that pool of play is really, really small. And I think that's why it then inflates the price of it, because there's probably a handful of players who are available in this market.
I also think when you zoom out and you realize just how much faster the game has got now, more than ever before, that players have even less time on the ball. There's even more pressure. Teams have got better defenses than they've ever been before and are generally better at, you know, orchestrating a press. And it means that the quality to be a player like this in central midfield has got even higher. I imagine this is also psychologically, this isn't just technically and sort of tactically. And I guess that when you're also recruiting these players, that you need to almost see evidence that they can do it. It's not going to be enough to say, oh, okay, I think I see something in their game to make it sort of worth the money. It's not, it almost feels less like a striker where you go, oh, I can sort of coach them to finish, because if you can't play central midfield to that high level, that is almost one of the worst positions. They always say, like, if you lose the midfield, you sort of lose the game sort of thing. And whether that is provable with data necessarily, I'm not sure, but definitely from a coaching perspective, it feels like the one area where you go, we don't want to lose that part because the central area is where the goal is. We need to defend that. So that to me makes perfect sense. And I think Bellingham now is the perfect example of that everything midfielder. And of course, the shirt number is what ties into that neatly. But remember Mark and I in the World Cup writing on his first game against Iran, where he was just, and it was, I think it was his first England goal he scored in that game, but just so central to everything, being able to do all of it. And I think I've used this analogy before, but I liken it to the cricket all-rounder, where when you've got a player that can do all the sides of those games, you can then play them on their own, and then you're not playing the double pivot. You've got a single player in there, you get another attacker, you get another defender, and that then gives you quality. You can reinforce a weakness, you can add to a strength. It just makes you a better team, because that's how you do it.
Essentially, having the best possible player in whatever league you're in this position, is going to make it seem like you have an extra player on the pitch because of what the best players add in this position, given its importance in all aspects of the game.
I think so. And it's also the fact that I think central midfielders or defensive midfielders are often bought with the expectation like they're going to play every game. They're going to be a 90-minute player every single week. They're going to be 40, 50, 60 games a season. They're not someone that you bring in to say, oh, okay, you're going to be a bit part player, or we need you for these parts of the season, or to come on and change games. This is like first name on the team sheet. And it happens the same, I think, with centre-backs at times as well, of this is the core of the team. Everything else we can, you know, I feel like even top teams will chop and change wingers. You can chop and change your number nine depending on the opposition, but it's like, you're the player every single game without fail. We need you fit, which is obviously harder to do now. We need you on it all the time. It's just, I think the demands for perfection there are higher than anywhere else, even though I think strikers and goalkeepers get more like over-analysis and more either amazing or complete failure critiques just because they're so goal-related and outcome-related.
Yeah, really the heartbeat, I think, is what we're talking about here, the heartbeat of football in the centre of the park. And as discussed, as per Liam's piece, which is out today on The Athletic, which I would suggest that you go and read, there's a lot of them in the dugout now, at the very, very top of the game. And boy, do they appreciate players that they recognise as, you know, a bit of them. That's what we've been discussing today. We've also discussed whether or not football has become too homogenous at the top level, and be really interested to hear the thoughts of you guys listening. I feel like if you're listening to this podcast, it's probably the sort of thing that you might have been thinking about, the sort of thing that you may think is a problem or not at all a problem. You might absolutely love it. Might be the sort of thing that you guys are chatting about with friends as well. So do get in touch with us. We'd love to hear from you. You can tweet us. You can also comment on the Athletic site, on the podcast page. Each episode has its own comments section, so it'd be great to hear from you on there. Make sure you sign up to The Athletic today so you can read everything that Liam, Mark and their colleagues are writing. Theathletic.com/tactics is the best place to go to sign up today for an annual subscription. We'll be back again next week on The Athletic Football Tactics Podcast.
The Athletic.